Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Training Tidbits podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge from Animal Training Academy, and I'm extremely excited about being back in your eardrums to talk all about best practice behavior management for what is set to be another amazing episode. I can't wait to dive in and learn all about today's guest and their learning odyssey. If you haven't checked the past episodes out yet, then make sure to head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and you can listen to them all there, or you can also find them on iTunes and/or on Stitcher. There is definitely something there for absolutely everyone, as well as some sensational up-and-coming episodes planned over the next wee while. Just before we do get started though, I'd like to take this opportunity to share some of the really exciting things happening with ATA. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area. Some of the ingredients of the membership include forums with hundreds of training videos and projects, where together the community helps problem solve different training situations. We then have the private Facebook group where we share animal training successes, members' updates, and relevant content from the web. On top of this, we have WhatsApp chat groups with separate group chats for horses, dogs, cats, birds, exotic animals, and more. Via these groups and direct from your smartphones, you can engage in text message-based conversations with an international community of positive reinforcement animal trainers. And then to top it all off, we connect live twice a month in members-only live web classes, where we dive even deeper into the topics you will learn about here. To find out more about membership and how you can join the community and carry on the conversation, visit www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu. But we will get started on today's episode, where I'm going to be talking to Emma Parsons. Emma is currently a canine behavior training consultant for Surefire Dogs in Boston, Massachusetts, as well as owning her own business. She specializes in managing and rehabilitating the reactive and aggressive dog. She is the author of two highly popular books on the subject, Click to Calm, Healing the Aggressive Dog, and Teaching the Reactive Dog Class, Leading the Journey from Reactivity to Reliability. Emma is a faculty member and instructor of Karen Pryor Academy for Animal Training and Behavior, as well as of the Karen Pryor Clicker Expo conferences. She gives Click to Calm seminars around the world, teaching others how to manage and rehabilitate reactive and aggressive dogs. She is a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers, the APDT, and a certified dog behavior consultant, CDBC, of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants. Emma holds a BA degree from the University of Massachusetts and shares her life with her husband Greg and their four clicker trained competition obedience/agility dogs, three Goldens, Lizzie Taylor, Caden Blue, Austin Rock, and a Papillon, Wiley Ray. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Emma Parsons to the show today. Emma, how are you?
Good. Thank you, Ryan.
You're very welcome. We're going to dive straight into the first question today, Emma. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first started to learn about positive reinforcement animal training and share some of the stories of the first animals that you ever worked with using positive reinforcement?
When I had Ben, my golden retriever, that is who Click to Calm is about, when I rehabilitated him. Traditionally, I used choke collars, prong collars with my first set of dogs. When I got Ben as a puppy, his breeder made me swear that I would use positive reinforcement training with him, because she, also a traditional trainer, had already started learning about positive reinforcement training and vowed she would never go back. So one of the conditions that I had to meet when I obtained Ben was that I would use positive reinforcement training to teach him all of the skills needed to compete in obedience competition. So I absolutely was excited to do it. I worked with a coach by the name of Patty Russo, who was in the States, and we are talking that's back in the 1990s. She was a very, very successful obedience competition trainer. And she was the first one who taught me about positive reinforcement training. The first thing she did is had me read the book, Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor, which, if you know more about my history, it was so important that I had read that book, because when I ultimately worked with Karen Pryor herself, I understood a lot about learning theory that I had never learned before. So that is where I started with my positive reinforcement training. Back then, I was using a verbal marker. I was not using a clicker. I started using a clicker maybe about a year into Ben's training when he started to have his aggression issues. And it was Karen Pryor who taught me how to use the clicker. So with Ben, I wanted a dog to compete with. I bought him, again, from this breeder, and probably by the time he turned about 6 months old, I started to notice him starting to growl at other dogs. Back then, I was extremely, I would say, ignorant of dog behavior. I will admit that, because prior to this, I never had an issue with any of my dogs. They were always quite friendly with dogs and people. So when I saw this growling that Ben was displaying, I immediately was really nervous about it because it frightened me, actually. And I ended up taking him to an expert in aggression, and who ended up hanging him on a prong collar, which made his aggression extremely worse. So not only would he growl and sometimes bark at other dogs, but now he was actually certainly growling and barking, but he was really lunging. He would have his teeth bared. Saliva would drip down both sides of his mouth, and it was extremely difficult to watch. And being the president of New England Dog Training Club at the time, it was extremely embarrassing. So I knew that I needed help. I ended up going to a dog training meeting in Hawaii, and that was just actually a task that I had to do because, I mean, I was involved in the obedience training world at the time, but it was there that I met Karen Pryor, who talked about clicker training, and I thought to myself, you know, I am at a loss on how to help Ben at this point. So maybe I should talk to her about how to use the clicker. So to make a long story short, I went to her during a lunch hour. And I think it's funny because I think she was probably trying to get away from the people because she was, I remember her sitting at this table near the elevators. And I asked her and I said, and I was very shy at the time. So I remember saying to her, could you help me with my dog, Ben? And of course, she asked me to tell her what was happening. So I did. And I'll always remember what she said to me. She said, well, you can just click. And I said, what do you mean just click? And she said, well, when he's not displaying the aggressive cues, you can mark that behavior with a click. And I said, no, you don't understand. He doesn't stop. He's yelling and screaming, and he's got saliva dripping down both sides of his face that he's starting to slip in. So I said, it's impossible. It's absolutely impossible to click him. And what she said to me was, well, he does breathe, doesn't he? And I said, oh yeah, he's breathing, all right. And she said, stop there. Look at the behavior of the dog and watch his breath. And when he takes the breath, see if you can click him at that time. So when she said that to me, my first thought was, I'm in trouble because that's going to be absolutely impossible to do. But what she was trying to teach me back then was differential reinforcement of low intensity behavior, which is we certainly can mark behavior that is at the lowest point, even if sometimes you don't have the absence of the behavior at that point. And that was something that I'd struggled with Ben, because I did go to other trainers who said, well, you can keep him in the environment until he's so tired that he will not be able to aggress anymore, and then you can reinforce it. But the problem with that is when I tried that, he started vomiting. So then I had to take my, you know, vomiting, aggressive dog back to the van and very, very upset because I thought nothing's working. So at any rate, I worked with Karen for about 9 months and we started to shape that emotion that Ben felt when he saw dogs. My guess, knowing what I know now, is when the trainer punished him, I believe he punished him very severely, first of all, but also at the wrong time, because there was a moment where Ben was barking and lunging at his dog, and he said to me, give me the leash, I will show you how to do this. And at the time that happened, Ben had stopped, and so then Ben received this very severe correction. And I really think that Ben really thought his life was in danger when he saw dogs, because his world was turned upside down back then. So that was my very first time using clicker training. And then what was exciting is then I learned that clicker training is a very nice method to be able to get all kinds of behaviors, not just dealing with the emotions of the dog, because that is how I originally learned it.
So you had quite a few defining moments in your learning odyssey. And how great would it be if all breeders were like the breeders of Ben? There had to be a condition in acquiring this dog that you were going to use positive reinforcement. So I'm trying to form a picture in my mind of what it must have been like for you at the time. You mentioned that you were teaching others about training, and you described your dog Ben as salivaring so much he was slipping in his own saliva. He got to the point where he was vomiting. And you mentioned that you were embarrassed. Can you just build upon this part of your story a little bit more and share what it was like at that time and what drove you to go to Hawaii, and what can others take away from that story that might be in that same position that just feel a little bit lost and don't know where to turn?
Well, now, which is really nice, is we do have information about knowing how to work with that type of behavior in a positive fashion. But back then, there were only two authors who talked about aggression in a positive manner. And one was Patricia McConnell and one was Jean Donaldson. So what was very difficult for me is that here I was, president of New England Dog Training Club. I've never, ever had a dog really with a behavioral issue, and certainly not a severe one like this. And now I am left with this dog where I really had no one to turn to. I would go to any kind of seminar that I could with aggression in its name, only to find out that sometimes they would talk about a couple of positive reinforcement strategies, but you know, traditional training back then was much more the norm. Or there would be the type of situation where there would be participants in the workshop where, let's say, you had a dog that was nervous with other dogs. So there was the dog, the neutral dog in the corner, and then the other person would bring their dog in, and their dog would be just going crazy because they were not comfortable. And again, barking, lunging, whatever. And I'd always feel bad because sometimes the instructors would say, well, you know what, your relationship with your dog is not strong enough to get the focus, regardless of the fact that there's another dog in the room. And that is one of the biggest reasons that I decided to write my book. And the reason for that was because it is a whole nother behavior to teach. It really has nothing to do with relationship. I mean, it does, because obviously if you have a good relationship with your dog, you want to teach them in a very positive manner, in a very giving manner. And we want the dogs to make the choice. Back then, we didn't think about the fact that the dogs make a choice. So what was hard for me is not only was Ben like this in public, and it was very embarrassing. I couldn't tell you how many times I'd walk, you know, I'd walk down the street not expecting to see a dog, and by golly, there would be one would appear, and people would yell at me and say, you know, your dog needs to be disciplined and you have to teach your dog. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, well, my dog knows a lot more than you can see right now, because he's a great competition dog. He's a great learner, but yet you can't see any of that because your dog is present in this environment. Not only was my life turned around, but my husband's too, because now we had to separate the dogs, because some of the fallout from that original correction, now Ben was not good with my dogs. At the time, I had an American Eskimo and two Kazans that were quite smaller than him. And although Ben was not a biting dog, dogs do not have to bite to injure other dogs. So, you know, now my husband, who is not a doggy person, well, I will take that back. My husband loves dogs. He never grew up with dogs. So he basically said, okay, well, Ben is going to be your responsibility because I am embarrassed by him. I'm not going to take him out. I don't know what to do with him. So luckily, he was on the same page and very supportive. But our whole life was changed because now Ben had to stay separate from the other dogs, which meant that now I had to mentally and physically stimulate all of my dogs at different times, which again breaks into the routine of the day. So we had to learn to live with Ben in a whole different way. Things like carrying your car keys and having them jingle could set Ben off in attacking one of the other dogs. My guess is because the jingling sounds like collar tags jingling. That's the only thing that I thought. So it was really difficult. And friends were not very supportive. They knew me. They knew the whole reason why I wanted to get a golden retriever to compete with. And many of them said, don't waste your time. Get rid of him. He is going to be useless to you. But then I thought to myself, once a dog is in my home, they are mine. And if I decide to have Ben euthanized, then that will be me that's going to decide it. And I will be with him. But I wasn't ready to give up just then. I feel like I hit rock bottom. And that is why I ended up going to see Karen Pryor in Hawaii and to discover that she lived very close to me, actually. So that was a gift. That was awesome.
This is such an important story. I mean, you could have just given up. It would have been the easy way out, but you didn't. How long did this whole thing take from getting Ben to going through the situation where you took Ben to the trainer who used the aversive training techniques on him to eventually, having that other defining moment and meeting Karen Pryor? How long, what sort of time period are we talking about here?
So I saw the reactivity with him when he was about 6 months old. He went to the aggression expert when he was about, I would say, 9 months old. And then I waited probably a couple of months to wrap my brain around this fact that he was as bad as he was at that point. And then I would say that I met Karen when he was about a year and, I don't know, about a year and a half, I would guess. But then it started to work out really well because I started to do the things that Karen suggested. And I would say within 6 months, you definitely saw a difference. Ben was a dog that had no threshold at all. A lot of the dogs that I work with now have thresholds. And if you're going to feed them, they're quite happy to accept the treats. Ben did not eat for a good month and a half when I first started this. That was another issue that was difficult. But I kept at it. And I would say a good 6 months, he started to develop a threshold. And what I mean by that is that I could go, because what I was doing is going to the dog training facilities that I had originally went to. But I parked way far away from the door where everybody would enter. And I would start clicking and feeding him for watching the dogs and the people coming and going. And so I would say it took about 6 months for him not to be reacting when he saw them. Then I started working on getting him closer to the building. And that probably took me probably another 6 months or so. There were definitely environments that he felt more comfortable in. I will say that the last environment that I knew when he could enter into this building, which was the New England Dog Training Club, it's in Cambridge, near Boston, Massachusetts. It was a big armory, and there were three classes going on in there all at the same time. And I knew that when I could take him in that building, I knew that I could probably think about actually showing him an obedience competition because it was a very difficult environment to be in. So that probably took me another year or so to be able to get him up to that level. But I did show him an obedience when he was three, and he did fabulous. He got his title in a weekend. I was going to continue. I did not with competition only because one of the exercises was leaving them in what we call long sits and downs, where dogs are asked to sit for 3 minutes and lie down for 5 minutes without you being in the room. And they're in a lineup of usually about 10 dogs. And I had taught Ben that if there was anything in the environment that he was concerned about, his response was to come to me. So I felt that it would not be fair to him to leave the room. Although friends of mine, the same friends who I have to say were not supportive in the beginning, were my biggest advocates after the fact, would say, well, you know, we can stay ringside and jump in if something happens. And I thought that was unfair. It just doesn't make sense to me. The whole point about competing is the dog being there by himself. So I did not continue with that. But one of the things I am most proudest of, and it happened probably when he was about 5 years old, is he got his Canine Good Citizen title. And what was so exciting about that is that he had to be near another dog without me giving him lots of reinforcement. You know, you had to go up and meet someone who was also had a dog on leash. And he did that beautifully. And that really showed me how far he had come. I was very proud of him at that point. He then went on to become my quote unquote neutral dog in my reactive dog class because, you know, he was taught that if a dog barked at him, then he gets lots of jackpots. And at that point, he was very happy about being around barking dogs because he would get lots of jackpots. So I have really old video of him doing this. And you would never know this dog had an issue in his life. So it was a very important journey. If you asked me back then that I was happy I took it, I would say heck no, because it was very difficult on many aspects. But now I feel so blessed to have been down that path with him and able to share that journey with others. Because one of the things that I notice when I meet clients, whether they're private students or whether they are in my reactive dog classes, is it is very difficult if you do not have a dog like a reactive or an aggressive dog, it is very difficult to understand what it's like to live every single day with them. And that's what many of my students have told me, that not only are the training methodologies helpful, but the fact that they can talk to me, they can cry with me on the phone, they can express the joy, you know, the first time that their dog looks at them versus looking at another dog or a child or a person, et cetera, that they will never forget that moment. And I can share that with them because I also can remember when those things happened. So although it was probably one of the most difficult journeys I will ever take with any dog, it was extremely important and one that I'm always happy to share.
I want to move on to the next question, but one thing that stuck out to me and what you just said, so just touching this really quickly is, and this is what I was looking for, is you took responsibility for that animal. Can you just speak to this quickly? You said this animal is in my house, it's my responsibility, and you did what was necessary.
Right. I knew that he needed things that I had to provide for him. The dream of me having a competition obedience dog had to be put on hold. So the dream, I think we have dreams with every dog that we get, whether it's to rescue a dog that has been traumatized, whether it is to get your top agility dog, your top obedience dog, or whatever the case may be. But I do think that every time we have a dog enter our lives, we do have certain dreams that you want to partake in with that dog. And when this all happened with Ben, I knew that I needed to put all of my needs aside, and I knew that I needed to take responsibility for him. And part of that was giving him the education and the skills that he needed. You talked about trusting the methodology. The issue back then is that I had nowhere else to turn. If this methodology was not going to help him, then I would have to euthanize him. That I had no question about that. The breeder, trying to be supportive, said, you know, I will take him back. I knew she would euthanize him if that was the case. But he is my dog. From the moment he was a puppy and he entered into my house, he is my dog, and I will give to him whatever he needs. Happily and luckily, I was able to be blessed with working with Karen Pryor, who had so much experience. I never would have been able to do this on my own. So I did have a guide. I did have a coach that helped me through this. But had that not happened, I would have to make the decision of putting him to sleep. And if that was the case, I would have to be there with him. I would never, ever, because of his severe issues, would have given him back to the breeder. I would not have given him to a rescue. He would not have went anywhere else because he is mine. And I have to do what's right by him, you know, and that was difficult because like I said, I bought him for different reasons. I will tell you, I am a different person now than I was back then. Back then, it was all about how the dog can serve me. I'm going to teach them in great ways and we'll have this great relationship. But it was all about me. It was all about what I wanted to do with the dog. Ben taught me that it has to be about him, because if it's not about him, he is not going to survive. And I have taken that message forward with my own dogs. So now they get to choose the sport that they want to participate in. And I just have to end up teaching it to them and taking an interest in it with them. And that has also led me down some really cool and fun paths. So yeah, I do believe that. That is, you know, I will say that I do have friends who I adore, who definitely have goals with dogs. And if it doesn't work out, you know, certainly they may rehome them. But in those cases, those dogs are mentally stable. I don't know that I could do it personally, but they are mentally stable and they can certainly pick up and have a life with another family. Ben had no other choice. Ben had no other options. I had to provide those for him. And I'm happy it worked out the way that it did. But I also meet a lot of people that it does not work out that way and who will say to me, you know, boy, I wish I would have met you way long time before. But we only do what we can do, and we can only teach the dogs what we know. So that's how it worked out for us.
So many gems in there. And I'm gonna quote an ex-US president, but I'm going to change it, the quote, a little bit. It's not what the dog can do for you, it's what you can do for the dog.
Right. Exactly.
Hey, I think we can do a whole podcast on Ben. And I love hearing about people's behavior odysseys, but we will move on. But before we do, thank you so much for sharing all of that, Emma.
No, you're welcome.
For the next question, I want to remind everyone listening about the title of one of your books, Click to Calm. We've mentioned it a couple of times already. Can you run us through the idea, although we have a pretty good one already, behind this title and dive a little bit deeper in how Click to Calm works?
So Click to Calm is about teaching dogs who have been formerly nervous or overstimulated or whatever the adjective is to start to become calmer when they are in the presence of those stimuli, I guess we can call it. If you have a dog that is barking and lunging at another dog, or you can fill in the blank, another dog, another person, maybe it's children running, maybe it is dogs running. It all works the same way. Basically, what we teach is that we start to reinforce them for looking and hearing that stimulus when they're in that environment. If we start using the clicker to mark when they are looking at, let's call it X, then they will start looking at X and then their head will turn back to the handler to get reinforced. Now that will happen assuming that there is an adequate threshold. So the threshold is that invisible line where the dog can look at the stimulus and be curious but not overreact. And again, that is going to be very different for many dogs. About 95% of the dogs that I see do have a threshold. And once we define that, then we certainly can move in and out of that space and reinforce them for looking at the handler. So we start with that first, I call it stage one. And then we would move into stage two. Well, now you have the dog looking at the stimulus. They look back to get the cookie. They look back at the stimulus. So their head is bouncing. I call that bouncing. And then once their head is bouncing back and forth, then what I do is have the handler start to reinforce them more for looking at them. I think we can all agree that when we are out in public, we want to have a dog who is, you know, comfortable and focusing on us to be able to receive cues depending upon what environment that they're in. So when I have clients who have dogs that, let's say, are very, you know, reactive, we'll just call it reactive, although I'm not a fan of the word, only because reactive means something's reacting. And if dogs didn't react to things, they'd be dead. So, you know, I think of it as an overstimulation. So, you know, if you can be out on a walk, let's say, and every time your dog sees another dog, and instead of pulling towards them or barking at them, etc., they turn to you for guidance, then I think that's a great thing. And I think across the board, we can say that that's a very favorable behavior for our dogs to do. So that is always my goal with my students, because then when you have a dog that is not reacting and you have a dog that is watching and listening per se, then you can cue them to do something. And it could be, hey, do you want to go meet that dog here? I'm going to let you off your leash. You can go do that. Or stay with me because there are 10 other dogs in the area or whatever. So that is the methodology. The stage one is clicking and feeding the dog for looking at that stimulus, whether it's another dog, person, child, etc. And then after you get that bouncing of the head back and forth, then you can start really reinforcing them, increasing your rate of reinforcement for looking back at the handler. So now you have a dog, and this is the part that I love the best, is that instead of seeing the stimulus and trying to distract your dog away from it, now what happens is the dog sees the stimulus and the dog sees that as the cue to look at you, the handler, and then to be able to receive subsequent cues, which I love that, because it's you don't have to body block, you don't have to try to pull the dog away. I also love the fact that it's the dog's choice. It is always the dog's choice whether or not to turn their head away from that stimulus to receive his reinforcement. So there's just so many wonderful things in the methodology that I love that really works well no matter what issue the client seems to have.
So a couple of things that I wanted to build on there. You mentioned identifying a threshold for the dog. Can you help build upon some things you mentioned in Ben's story? And I hope I'm going in the right direction here. But for those listening who have a dog who's overstimulated in the house, for example, there might be a window that people pass by or other animals in the house the dog's reacting to. What tips do you have for people that are in this situation who have to live in that space and constantly be aware of this?
So in those situations, and again, it is a big variability between dogs that are stimulated a little bit and dogs that are stimulated a lot. And one of the first things I always teach is that we're always managing or teaching behavior. There's never a time that your dog is not learning. So we will discuss things like covering up windows, keeping shades down. Although I will say that I'm not a fan of a client having these big, beautiful windows that in a house that they live in and then covering all of them up or shutting all the shades, because I do think that it's important for them, especially with a dog like this, to remain positive and have the sun come in and all of those things. Because I think if we do too much, that they start to resent it. So usually what I do is ask them where the dog's safe space is. If they do not have one, I recommend that they establish one. A safe space can be anything from a crate to a baby gated bathroom to a finished basement, etc. For me, my safe space is in my basement. They have these big kennels and they know when they go in there, they're just chilling. So usually with a client, there's a certain time of day where there's more reactivity going on. You know, it could be that their windows face a school, and every time the school children come to school and then leave, it's more difficult. So I have them pinpoint those times and have them put the dog in the safe space during those times for mentally stimulating meals. I always want my clients to have the dogs either be training them or eating out of mentally stimulating toys instead of eating out of bowls. So we will pick those times at which to feed the dog and give the dog something else to do. So any way that we can get the dogs out of the windows during that time is a really wonderful thing. The difficulty with reactivity in the house where it's constant is that the handler cannot work with the dog every single second of the day. So in the more severe cases, I have had dogs who are reacting not only with people outside, but they're also reacting when they hear the toaster or they hear the microwave or they hear the washing machine. And those dogs I do send to a veterinary behaviorist if the handler will consent to see if medication would help with some of that. Because a lot of times these dogs are very anxious And every sound that they hear is just a reason to become reactive. And it's just not a healthy way for the dog to live. I know sometimes turning furniture around can help. You know, a lot of my clients have these big bay windows, and that's where dogs will perch themselves watching people walking up and down the street with dogs and bikes and et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes if they take the couch and move it against a different wall, then the dogs are not so apt to go to that nice big bay window where they just perch themselves all day and watch it. A lot of times these dogs too are not mentally stimulated enough. So this is their actual way of mentally stimulating themselves. So we talk about those pieces as well.
So I like the way you described all of this. And at the start there you said you might have a reactive dog and you identified why you don't potentially like that word. And you said whatever adjective you use to describe your dog. So when we're doing this, do you think about it purely in form of behavior, or are you thinking about shaping emotions? For example, taking a dog from fear and frustration to confidence and contentment, I think is a phrase that you use with your book. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the way I think about it is when a client tells me they have a certain behavior issue, I do identify the behavior and I think about what is happening before it and what is happening after it so that I can have a framework in which to work within, I guess is a good way to put it. The difficulty with issues like these is that clients are very emotional about it. There's a huge emotional component to this behavior. When I think about behavior in general, we tend to think about things like teaching dogs maybe obedience cues, like heeling and sits and downs and things like that. So it is different when we talk about, I think about it as shaping emotion, but if we think about it, emotion is really what kind of behavior do we want these dogs to have when they're being exposed to the stimulus that right now is making them very whatever you want to call it again, because I don't know, you know, is the dog frustrated? Does the dog want to really meet the other dog? Are they petrified of the other dog? You know, we don't really know. And one quote that I love that Karen had taught me was, you never want to make training decisions based on what you think the dog is thinking. So I try as an instructor to not necessarily think about what the dog is thinking per se, but I do look at the behavior. I look at the signals that the dog is exhibiting, and then I pretty much work from there. I think it's important that dogs get to choose. I think the option of choice is huge when you are working with issues like these, because us humans, sometimes what happens is because we know that nothing bad's going to happen to the dog. You know, if you have a dog who's very shy with people or fearful of people or whatever the case may be, you know, as humans, we try to have them meet more people. We know it's a good thing to socialize them, et cetera, but if the dog is showing signs that they don't think that's a great idea, and humans continue to overexpose them, then you have dogs that are realizing that the cues they are trying to communicate are not working. So then you may have an escalation of that behavior into something like growling, you know, barking, biting, lunging, et cetera, et cetera. So I always see it as starting with the behavior. That's the issue. Looking at what is actually reinforcing it, trying to change the environment to try to get this dog successful and this handler, because a lot of times they feel, you know, they are very upset. They have tried very hard in their own way to make this work. But sadly, a lot of times they don't realize that they're actually causing more harm than good. But all of those things I do look at when I meet with a, let's say, a private client, for example.
Great information. And I know there's loads of people who listen to this show for whom this is going to be highly beneficial. So thank you very much for sharing that. And the other book you've written is called Teaching the Reactive Dog Class. So this is for a little bit of a different audience, leading the journey from reactivity to reliability, which just sounds amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about this book?
I wrote this book for two reasons. One, it is for all those teachers and instructors who are thinking about teaching a reactive dog class. Many times when I give my workshops and seminars, I do have participants who want to offer this class in their facilities, but not sure how to get started and not sure what pace to take with these types of dogs. So that is one audience that I wanted to give that information to. The other is that I will on occasion get emails from people who have a dog with these issues and they're not sure how to get started. They don't have the availability of coming to a seminar or a workshop, and they certainly do not have reactive dog classes in the area. So they say, you know, what can I teach and at what pace should I teach it at? So that is another audience that I intended for this book. So teaching a reactive dog class is basically how to set up the environment to have a certain number of dogs with dog reactivity issues or aggression issues, it depends, and being able to start to build calmer behavior. What I think is funny about this is when I started teaching reactive dog classes, my situation is that after Ben's success, people started to really refer me out. And I was only one person, and I can't go all over the place all of the time. So I thought to myself, I wonder if I can get people in a group and do, let's say, about 6 to 8 private lessons all at the same time. So I was able to talk to a person who owns one of the dog training facilities locally, where she has lots of walls and things like that. And so I decided to give it a shot. So what I found is that if you first educate the handlers about what a clicker is and how to handle it, et cetera, and you have them start working with the dog at home, and then you take the dog in to the facility one at a time, introducing it to them very gradually, then by the time you actually get them into the building, the dogs seem really happy about doing their clicker training work behind barriers. And that's probably the easiest way to explain it. So what I found is that I did a couple of experimental classes just to see how they would go. And it was amazing to me how when we had 6 dogs, and I think most of them at the time were dogs that were not good with other dogs. These people could not walk down the street with them. And how within 6 weeks, we could actually get them in the room working on their clicker training skills and starting to come out one by one and feeling more comfortable with each other. It was very, very exciting. The book talks about that. It talks about what one does from weeks 1 through 6. And again, I will make the statement here, the dogs are the one who makes the choice. So weeks 1 through 3 is basically about getting the people in, teaching them how to click a train. Dogs come in the building and then they come in behind barriers. But weeks 4 through 6 is run at the dog's pace. So when I'm teaching, I take the dog that's having the hardest time and we run at that dog's pace because, again, the dogs are not going to be reverting back. I mean, there's no point in doing that. My explanation is if I do not see any reactivity in that room, then I know I'm doing my job. And that is what I share with the clients as well. The thing about teaching a class like this in a building is that we do not have the ability to open up walls, right? So what we do is instead of using distance, we use time. So I do have certain dog and handler teams that will come into the room for about 5 minutes, leave for a little while, come back in, etc. But my only point is that we will go as fast as the dog will allow us to. One thing to say about that is that this class runs really well with the help of my assistants, who just about every single one of my assistants grew out of the reactive dog class that they had taken with their dog and wanted to share this information with others. So we have about a 1-to-1 ratio of dogs and handlers, and they are just very supportive of these people because it's very hard for some of these people to actually come in to do this work. We have the assistants who will stay at things like the doors and the parking lot because the facility that I teach, there is another class going on the other side of the room. So we have to make sure that everybody stays safe. And I have had my share of assistants who really just are there to see dogs react and see, I don't know, some kind of exciting episode, but as I always say, if we do it right, we're not going to see it. So that is why I wrote the book. All of that is explained in the book. In the book, there's also a URL with the homework assignments for people. There's a website in there that they can go in and just steal those. You know, they can write their own, but they're certainly welcome to use the ones that I use as well. So that's basically why I wrote the book. And in the ideal world, I would love to see clients first privately, get them working, get the environment working for them at home and when they venture out, and then put them in a reactive dog class. But the reality of it is there are people who need help. They cannot afford to go to a veterinary behaviorist. They cannot afford to have me for a private lesson. They can't afford a class. So I will absolutely take them on one by one. They all have my email address. They can all text me. So for that amount of time, and even afterwards, as long as they're working on it, I am happy to give them any information that they need while they're trying to help calm their animal. So, but sometimes that was the only way that I can reach people, because they just can't. They just can't afford to do anything else.
Emma, sounds like you need to start making some online courses.
I know. I know. That's on my list of to-dos.
Any more books on the cards?
I would like to write book. Actually, there are certain things that I would like to write. I would like to write about Click to Calm again. I think the Teaching a Reactive Dog class, if you read that book, that is more updated as I continued seeing clients and as I continue to learn. I continue to change the methodology a little bit to make it a little bit more productive, because I know when I have clients, they want this behavior to be managed and, you know, moving along as quickly as possible. So I want to create a living book, as I called it, of maybe Click to Calm, with not only the explanations of how to work with particular dogs with particular issues, but also that you could, you know, click on a little link that says, okay, this is what you just learned in that paragraph. Now let's take a look at it. Because I think it's nice that learners can either read the descriptions or they could see them, how they're done correctly.
I think there's a lot of learners out there that are excited at that prospect. Hey, thank you very much for all of this, Emma. And we'll link to these books in the podcast write-up. I'll get you to provide me the links, the best links for those, so people can easily navigate to places and get their hands on copies of these books.
The other thing that I wanted to just quickly mention is that I had sent you a couple of videos of we have what is called a reactive dog party. So all of the students that are in that receive an invitation, I come up with all these reactive dog games. So I believe I sent you the ones with the Leslie McDivitt's Control Unleashed, the car crash game, but we're doing it with novel stimuli, so it makes it harder. And then we're doing things like relay races. And what's so exciting about these videos is that these are dogs that, again, really couldn't walk down the street. They couldn't see dogs from their windows at home. They had a really hard time to manage these dogs. And now they've just come so far. So it's so fun to get them together. We do this about maybe 3 times a year. And I come up with all these challenging things for them to do. And they are so happy when their dogs can play these games. And the dogs are just 100% better. So it's really exciting for all of us.
I'm excited. Reactive dog parties.
Reactive dog parties. Yeah. Who would have thought?
If someone told you when you first were working with Ben about 6 months into working on his behavior that you'd be throwing reactive dog parties.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't have believed it. Nope.
Hey, for this next question, I'd really love to learn about your work with the Karen Pryor Academy, and specifically about becoming certified through the Karen Pryor Academy. Can you talk to this for us?
Sure. So the Karen Pryor Academy is a course that students take to learn about clicker training and about the learning theory principles. So the curriculum consists of, they take an online course, they have written assignments, they have training exercises that they do, and then at the end there are a couple of training and teaching assessments that they must pass to be certified. It is a very exciting course. It is a lot of work, I would say. You know, it's hard to take courses, you know, especially a 6-month course, because you learn so much and there is so many things to try and experiment with, et cetera. And they go through the course, they gain so much knowledge from it, and then they are just so happy that they were able to accomplish it all. And it just makes me so thrilled. A lot of my students are people who are just starting to get into the dog training industry. Some want to work in the zoos. And then I have some older people who are changing careers, who want to become dog trainers or open up grooming shops or pet sitting services, etc. And I just think it's extremely beneficial. I wish that there was a course like this that I could have taken way back when, because, you know, I basically, as Patty recommended, read Don't Shoot the Dog and learned it from there. And then I had, you know, the wonderful opportunity of working alongside Karen Pryor, but not all of us get that wonderful opportunity, right? So this is a way to learn from Karen through the information and work with a bunch of really great faculty instructors. All of them are very accomplished in their own right. I know for my students, again, I go out on the limb for them. They're my students. I will give them everything, not only the pieces of the curriculum, but also the information that I have learned as I have come through my experiences in this industry. So it's very exciting and very fun, very nice.
Sadly, we are nearly at the end now, but that's okay, because we're also heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show. And this is story time. Emma, can you please share with everyone listening 2 or 3 more stories from your experience training animals so far and some of the important lessons these have taught you along the way?
Yeah, so let's see. There's a couple things. Of course, I apologize if they're surrounding Ben again, but Ben was the biggest teacher that I think I have had. So there is one point in Ben's rehabilitation where he was pretty much able to go into any environment at any time. And I went to a agility session with my instructor, and she had a dog there with her. We had our class and we were almost leaving, and she said to me, "Emma, do you think Ben could meet my dog?" And I said, "No, Ben doesn't meet dogs." He might meet dogs. I mean, he got to the point where if he looked like he wanted to meet a dog, you know, we'd set something up, et cetera, et cetera. But at any rate, he definitely didn't meet dogs in training facilities, for sure. But then she said to me, "But I thought you said he was better with dogs." And I said, "Well, he is, but we just had a lesson." So after much attempting to stick to my original thoughts, I thought to myself, you know what, maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing. Maybe I should introduce Ben to her dog. It's a good test, I guess. So stupidly, I will say, I had Ben with me. She had her dog, and her dog was a very, very old pit bull. And she said, "Well, you know what, even if Ben attacks her, you know, she doesn't even have teeth to bite him back with." And I thought to myself, this is just foolish. Why am I doing this? But I consented. So I said to Ben, "Ben, would you like to meet this dog?" And that was my cue back then when I was experimenting about seeing if he wanted to actually meet dogs. I'd say, "Ben, do you want to meet dogs?" And either he would look at me and his body would get all waggy, or he'd go behind me and growl. So I said, "Ben, would you like to meet this dog?" So he looks at the dog and looks at me and takes a couple steps back. And I said, "Ben, would you like to meet this dog?" So at this point, he takes a couple steps forward. And then finally, I got frustrated and I said, "Ben, go and meet that dog." And so Ben very slowly walked up to the dog and then jumped on the dog and started to aggress on the dog. Now, Ben was not a biter, so I wasn't afraid that he would bite this dog, but he was, you know, had the dog on the ground, etc. So I pull him off and I'm very ashamed. Even if I'm very ashamed, but I pulled him off. I look at him. He's got blood dripping down the side of his face. And I just basically turned on my heel, went into the car, very upset at myself, not upset at the dog, very upset at myself, because this dog who had learned to trust me and my decisions I made for him, I forced him into meeting a dog that he didn't even want to meet, which was just ridiculous. And I assume it was from the pressure of wanting to please. And of course, very upset at myself. Anyway, the thing that I thought was very interesting is that I get in my car. Back then, I did not have crates. They would ride with me in the car, but they were very good. Now all my dogs are in crates, I will say that. But he would sit with me in the middle of the car, right? So my driver's side, there's a space in the passenger seat. He'd always sit beside me in that little empty space. This time I opened the car door for him to get in. He goes to the very back of the van. And I looked at him and said, "Ben, come on, I'm sorry. Come on, back up." He totally ignored me. I drove home, he stayed in the back of that van. He ignored me for 2 days. Now, if you would have told me that somebody experienced this, I would have said, "That's ridiculous. How do dogs know that?" This dog is always, there was never a time when this dog did not drive in that same place until that day. And he did not drive in that same place until like 3 days later. So I just think it's really important. I think that I hate to put human terms on this, but the only way I can explain it as a human is I had this dog that trusted me. I betrayed his trust and his behavior changed. His behavior changed for at least 3 days after that. And what I thought was so interesting when I look back on it is that he was trying to tell me with every step, "Ben, meet the dog. Do you want to meet this dog?" No, he takes a step and looks at me, takes another step, looks at me. And he must have done that about 4 times until he was almost next to the dog, until I said, "Just go and do it." And then he ended up attacking the dog. And that's something that I'll never forget, right? Because I think those of us who have these dogs, especially when you work on it a lot, I think as humans, we like to think that it's fixed. We like to think that it's cured. But it's not. And it is all about letting the dog make the free choice, which I did not do that day. And it's just a very important lesson that I learned. And hopefully the listeners will learn that as well. So that's one of my stories.
It's interesting, isn't it? The influence that pressure can have on us to potentially make us do things that in hindsight,
yes,
seem a little bit absurd.
Right.
In that story, and we haven't really touched on this specifically in this podcast, although you've mentioned it so many times, I think it's worth at this point to just spend a bit of time reflecting on it. Can you just talk to the importance of choice?
Dogs need to be able to make choices just like people do. It's hard because I'm just sitting here thinking about choice as such a general, just a general term, but yet I know everything that I do with my own dogs, as well as Ben, it is all about choices. So one of the first things that always come to my mind is when I hear home management described as, you know, the nothing in life is free. I always think to myself, when I'm working with a client and their dog, and again, I see a lot of dogs that have really severe aggression issues. So one of the most important things I like is to improve that relationship between the handler and the dog. And one of the things that I work with is what I call effective home management. And with that, it's about the dog and the person almost like taking turns in the home environment. You know, so things like the dog will sit to, you know, have the person give the meal or something simple like that. I just think that dogs need to understand, and it's humans, important for humans to understand how the world works. And I think it's important, especially dogs that have never had structure or dogs that have been traumatized or for whatever reason chose to communicate with people in a less than favorable ways in our eyes, right? Because dogs that bite and dogs that show all these other behaviors, for them, it's pretty natural. But for us, it's a problem because they live in our world. And I always say that. I feel bad for dogs in that sense because dogs, they can't really be the natural beings that they are a lot, right? Because they have to live in our world and certain behaviors are inappropriate for them to exhibit in our homes or, you know, when we're out in public. I think it's important for dogs to understand how their home environment works. If you look at some of the studies that I'm just learning about, if you give some animals a choice of either eating for free and just with food on the floor, or they can get their food from a mentally stimulating toy or contraption, many of them will choose to do so by taking the mental stimulation route, which I think is amazing. And when I work with clients who have dogs with aggression issues, sometimes without even doing any of the training, when we start to put structure in the dog's life, that, you know, they start to understand if you do X behavior, then this is the reinforcement for it, I think is really, really important for the dogs. I think it's a nice way for them to learn and a nice way for them to be able to relate to their surroundings so much better. The difficulty with humans is that we know what dogs we've had in the past, and we seem to shape our own reinforcement history with this dog by what we've experienced in the past. So that can be very confusing to the new dog. So I think choice is extremely important. Choice is something that we all need to be able to do. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
It's hard to explain, because I think a choice, there's just so many pieces. Because, you know, dogs need to be able to choose. I mean, they choose their behavior. They choose their behavior based on the reinforcement or the consequences, or however you want to explain it in the scientific terms. But choice is clarity for them. They need consistency. They need clarity. They need to understand this equals that. And one thing I know with clients is they don't really understand how much power they have in that respect. They don't really understand how much the dog really, if they have a dog that enjoys, let's say, human touch, enjoys the affection, enjoys, or what we call affection, right? Enjoys the playtime, enjoys the meal time. You know, there's a lot of reinforcement that they carry with them every day that a lot of my clients don't even think matter, that the dogs will just love. So I always think a part of my job is to, yes, help the dog practice better behavior, but also help the client really see how the dog perceives the world, so to speak, or as much as we can take from that, you know, depending upon the behavior that's illustrated once we make these changes.
So great. And unfortunately, that does now bring us to our final question for this episode. Emma, could you please take us all into the future and share with us what you would like to see transpire over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal/dog training world?
I would like to personally see, well, all of us, not only us as instructors and people who are studying the science of learning, but I would love to see general public become interested in learning how all beings learn. I think I know the clients I see in the general public tend to look at dog training as, I need to find a dog trainer who will tell me to do X. Now, the issue with that is that sometimes if you have dog trainers who do things just because their dog trainer before them said to do it, or then their instructor said to do it, we don't really understand the reasons why we're doing things. Like, we don't really understand that the learning theory that we use for people is the same learning theory that we use for dogs, giraffes, and elephants. I personally would love to see general public become interested in how dogs learn, but also how they can relate to dogs better. You know, I would love to say I would love all people who trained or who worked with dogs or whatever animals to use positive reinforcement. I mean, that is a given, certainly. But to do that, we also need to understand what behavior is and how it's reinforced and how it's created, et cetera, et cetera. I would love to see more bridges between us as positive reinforcement trainers, bridges into the traditional training as well. Because, you know, the difficulty with that is that if we put up walls as positive reinforcement trainers, traditional training is never going to change. It's the people who are practicing it are just going to get more defensive, and they're going to continue doing what they're doing, but they're not going to talk much about it. There's not going to be an interchange of ideas. And we all need to be learning. And I guess there is just some people who are just going to continue not wanting to learn. And that's what it is, I guess. But I just know in my own experience that different places that I've traveled to and talked to people, they want to do some traditional, you know, they've come from traditional training, but they want to learn more positive ways to do things. And I think it's important to invite these people in and help them, you know, help them where they're at, shape them to become more positive reinforcement trainers, because I think that will help them, and it makes us better. That's probably the biggest the biggest thing that I would like to see, because then we can share more ideas and, you know, you don't have the defensiveness that you might have now in training in general.
Such great vision. And as mentioned, that does sadly bring us to the end. Before we do wrap up though, Emma, can you just tell everyone listening where they can go to find out more about you and your books?
Sure. You can go to my website is www.emmaparsons.com. It's all one word. And there's information there just about how I teach, how to reach me if anybody has questions after hearing this podcast. And there's information there about, you know, my resume and the books, et cetera, et cetera. If they are interested in the Karen Pryor Academy, they can go to Karen Pryor's website, which is www.clickertraining.com. They can go there. There's information there about, you know, techniques for whatever species of animals you're training, as well as equipment, as well as how to become involved in the Karen Pryor Academy as students if they'd like to pursue that. And they are doing it worldwide, so there's information there. And if they have questions, they can certainly email me. My email is creativecanine. It's creativ, no e at the end of it, but the letter K, number 9 at AOL.com. And I'm happy to answer anybody's questions should they have any.
That's very generous of you, Emma. Thank you for that. And we will link to all of this stuff in the podcast write-up as well, including links to Emma's books. So before we get to the final words, Emma, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, thank you so much for making time to come on the show today. It's really appreciated.
Oh, you're very welcome. I hope it helps.
I'm definitely sure that it's going to inspire and assist a lot of people. Have you out there listening have enjoyed this episode today and you were interested in carrying on this conversation about the most positive and less intrusive ways of influencing behavior, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with like-minded, positive reinforcement-based animal trainers from around the world. Whether you train or are thinking about training dogs, cats, other pets, birds, zoo animals, implementing techniques within your vet clinic or any other area where behavior management is required, then you will love all the different ways you can join in. Whether it be the forums, WhatsApp chats, private Facebook group, live web classes, there's something there for absolutely everyone. And we're really looking forward to having you join the community. That's it for this episode, though. We will wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. High five, Beehive. You'll hear from us again soon.